Let's call a meeting of the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Committee to order. Representative Downey's got to be in another place at 1, so we got to start the process as soon as possible. We don't have a quorum yet. But Representative Leidiger moves House File 288 to pass and be sent to taxes. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's your motion?
That's my motion, sir.
Okay, with that, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to provide just a brief background of the bill and its history so you understand the context, and then I have a couple of folks to explain some of the details and talk a little bit about how this actually works in real life. So with that, I'll just get started, and if there's questions along the way, I think we'll take them along the way unless you wish differently.
Well. We have a quorum now, so we'll officially call the meeting to order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 288 is not new. It was in the governor's proposed budget 2 years ago. Representative Winkler also carried it 2 years ago, and it is a close companion to the Angel Investment Tax Credit bill that we did actually pass a year ago as part of the off-year session. So there's a bit of a history here, and it is intended to try to stimulate the early stage capital world, the need for capital in small businesses. And there's an important distinction between the Angel Investment Tax Credit bill that we passed, which is very much geared towards the early stage startup type of company, prototype mode, looking for FDA approvals, real early stage companies where it's pretty high risk capital that you're putting into play. And this bill, which you may have heard called the CAPCO bill, the target for this bill is actually to get capital into the hands of existing businesses who are trying to grow and expand. And for those of you who maybe haven't followed the early stage investment community here in Minnesota, I think Minnesota was known actually throughout the country relative to our kind of size and presence geographically. We were known as a very dynamic source of seed capital. We had a lot of early stage investment. We had a lot of early stage company growth here. And over the last 5 to 10 years, that has dropped off for a variety of reasons, and these folks could probably tell you the particulars of that more than I can. But clearly what was once a very dynamic early stage industry complex here in Minnesota has been stunted, at least in part, perhaps even in large part, by the difficulties of trying to find early stage capital. And some of you may remember that the investment community, this kind of investment environment, was probably overly hot in the late 90s. People were investing in early stage companies simply as financial instruments to try and turn some kind of return on investment in a 2 to 3 year period. I think some of that highly speculative investment turned people into, yes, sir.
Representative Howes has a question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just before you go too far, are all of the copies like this, missing part of a page? Is that the secret code that you're using to circumvent government process?
Mr. Chairman, I knew Representative Howes would have a question on the bottom of that page, so we had the pages cut off for him.
Sure. I'm sure we'll get him a copy.
Well, is it an error? Can we have it fixed and get that page?
I believe.
You got it.
Mr. Chairman, his is also the same, so you might want to check everybody.
11, page 11.
Mr. Chairman, the one I just got is still the same. So they're really trying to pull something over on us, I think. Yeah.
You want to continue? We'll get copies to everybody very soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at my page 11, and actually the bottom half of that page is fairly important, so I encourage people to get copies and read that. But so the intention of this bill, Mr. Chair, is to not try to drive capital into extremely speculative investments. It's intended to drive capital into companies that actually have some kind of a track record and are looking to grow and expand and create jobs through their existing operations. And the mechanism that it uses as compared to the angel investment tax credit, which offers a tax incentive to early stage and angel type investors to get a tax credit against their personal income, the investment vehicle here is to encourage insurance companies who have large reserves to be encouraged, incented to invest in early stage growth companies through their reserves, and the mechanism to do that is a credit against their premium tax. And so this bill creates a $200,000 or $200 million in investment incentive, and at an 80% credit rate actually translates into a $160 million investment tax credit to those insurance companies. There's an intermediary contemplated in the bill. It's not assumed that these insurance companies would go out and invest directly into these companies, but they would leverage the expertise of LLCs and LLPs that specialize in early stage investment. And so the business investment company that we form here is an entity that has to get approved by deed. They would deploy the capital of the insurance companies into a portfolio of companies. Those companies have to be approved by deed as well, so there's an application process. The cost of the whole program, at least in terms of the internal administrative costs, are funded by the fees, the registration fees that the business investment companies and the registered participating companies pay to deed. So in terms of an actual operational cost, it's neutral. The fees from the companies applying pay for the cost of deed to do it. And the tax credit is scheduled out after 4 years, so that the short-term tax credit implication for our biennial budget is minimized. But maybe more importantly, members, it's to make sure that the types of investments that we're going after here are not short-term, are not quick financial turns on company portfolios, but really strategic longer-term growth in these small companies that simply want to grow and add jobs in their current business. So with that very brief description of the bill, let me turn it over to Paul Cassidy, and he can walk you through his experience in helping develop the bill.
Got one? Andrew, you guys, Representative Kiefer has a question.
I just really quickly, Representative, you mentioned the cost. You said fees are paid through, and who's paying the fees? Is it for application?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiefer, the registered investment companies go through a process with the Department of Employment Economic Development, and they pay a fee to get registered. And then any business that would be the recipient of the investments also goes through a certification process with deed, and there are fees attached to both of those activities that fund the internal operations of the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Take care of your question. Okay. Would you give your name for the record?
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the law firm of Leonard Street and Diner here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 288, the Minnesota Small Business Investment Act. I'm speaking today on behalf of our clients, Enhanced Capital Partners and Advantage Capital, investment firms that have been working on and promoting this program over the course of the last 12 years throughout the country. This program has been passed in 12 other states and has been reauthorized 38 times over the course of the last 12 years. This proposal addresses this committee's primary focus, immediate job creation and growing the tax base. To accomplish this, we need to provide incentives to unlock capital, if you will, for those who need it. The economic development tool under consideration today has a proven track record in many other states, including New York, Texas, Missouri, and our neighboring state, Wisconsin. It was recently passed in Tennessee and Connecticut. And in Wisconsin, Governor Walker is asking for his economic development proposal a $200 million reauthorization of the original program passed in 1998. It is also an economic development tool that comes at a time when our economic conditions have caused credit markets to tighten and capital to be scarce for many Minnesota businesses. That the next step for small businesses oftentimes may be difficult financially because many businesses are no longer bankable. They may present a great opportunity for investment, but they may also not meet the pro forma or financial model of their local banker. With nowhere to turn, these small companies have few options but to look to other venues such as the East and West Coast for additional capital, look to other states for financial assistance, forego expansion altogether and thereby miss the opportunity to grow jobs and tax revenues, sell their product or idea to another business, or just simply go out of business. This proposal is fairly straightforward, as Representative Downey alluded to. The Minnesota Small Business Investment Act would channel $200 million to growing Minnesota small businesses so that they can expand their operations and grow jobs in our state. To accomplish this, the MSBIA would have the Department of Economic Development license and regulate between 5 and 10 professional investment managers, such as Enhanced Capital Partner Mr. Korngold's company, to go out and pool the resources of large insurance companies into a $200 million investment pool. The investment managers would then invest those funds in local growing Minnesota businesses who may be having a difficult time finding financing from traditional sources, such as their local banker. The investment managers would be required by this proposal to target investments in small to medium-sized businesses, businesses with less than 100 employees and with operations located exclusively in the state of Minnesota. In exchange for the insurer providing the initial capital for the investment fund, the insurer would receive a tax credit against their premium tax obligation, but only after meeting certain funding and other criteria and investment thresholds have been met, including investments of the resources in targeted Minnesota companies. The tax credits do not kick in until 4 years from now in 2015. Assuming all the requirements contained in the legislation have been met, the tax credits would then be paid out over 4 years in equal 20% increments to the insurer. The tax credits may be forfeited if the investment managers do not invest the funds in qualified investments in a timely manner. Investment managers are not allowed to take out any profits until 100% of their investment funds have been invested in targeted qualified Minnesota businesses. The state of Minnesota would also benefit under this proposal through increased tax revenues and by participating in 10% of the profits that would be generated by the successful investments. This program has a proven track record that has succeeded in other states and has been improved upon numerous times over the years. This legislation before you represents 12 years of understanding what works and what does not work in building a successful economic development and capital investment program targeted at small businesses. Texas reauthorized another $200 million in tax credits last year after the success of an initial $200 million certified capital tax credit program initiated in 2004. Texas is already considering yet another round of $200 million in certified capital. The states of Tennessee and Connecticut recently passed this proposal as well. New York has now reauthorized the program 5 times. As I stated earlier, Governor Walker of Wisconsin is proposing reauthorization of Wisconsin's original program to the tune of $200 million. Mr. Chairman, this proposal enjoys broad support. It has been recommended by Governor Plenty's 21st Century Tax Commission, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Business Partnership, NFIB, Life Science Alley, and the High Tech Association, to name a few. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I have Mr. Korngold from Enhanced Capital with me to help out as well. Thank you.
Any questions from the membership? Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Is this CAPCO? Is this CAPCO?
Absolutely.
Okay. Any other questions? I wanted to know. Representative Leidiger.
The only thing I see that's different from the way we've done business before is the tax credit. Am I getting this bill correctly? Because insurance company's been able to invest in the past. Is it the tax credits that's different here?
Give your name for the record so we know you're here 100 years from now.
Michael Korngold. I'm the president of Enhanced Capital Partners. We participated in a variety of these programs, and as the programs have evolved, we've actually worked on legislation from a public policy perspective. And actually, to the representative's question, CAPCO is a name that is used broadly to cover a wide variety of programs, both programs that were started 15, 20 years ago that look nothing like the program that's before the committee today. Insurance companies are subject to capital requirements, reserve requirements. They would actually not be able, for the most part, to invest in small businesses in Minnesota and still get a credit as an admitted asset, which allows them to write their premiums. So they won't do so. If we were to try to raise capital from insurance companies for this purpose, for example, in the absence of a tax credit, they would never make that investment because it would not be an admitted asset. The tax credit, unlike some tax credits where you wonder would the behavior have existed in the absence of a tax credit, in this case, if you look at the history of insurance companies in Minnesota, they will not invest in this asset class in the absence of a tax credit.
Okay.
Any other questions from the members? Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to say thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's great. So many times when we're talking about businesses and attracting businesses, we forget about those that are already existing. And so this is a great way to help with that, to help create jobs in our state and economic growth in our state. So thank you very much.
Any other questions? Yeah, Representative Murray.
Mr. Chairman, I think, too, this is a great bill. My only question would be, a few years ago, we had a number of insurance companies that got dangerously low on their reserves when we went through some of the downturn in 2007 and 8. I was wondering, how did some of the programs that were already in effect at the time weather that, and, you know, were there any problems with, you know, their reserves at that point?
That risk is actually on the insurance company. One of the evolved mechanics of the program is that now with the tax credit delay, the insurance company is making their commitment up front. In fact, they're funding their entire investment up front. If it turns out down the road that they can't use that tax credit for any reason, again, that is their risk. It's carried forward until they can. But low reserves after they've made their investment determination would have no impact on this program.
Representative Donnie.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, maybe a follow-on answer. Representative Murray, so we've tried to really fine-tune the structure of the incentives and the parameters of the program. I think any investment portfolio, including what insurance companies are doing with their reserves right now, is probably going to include some kind of an early stage, slightly higher risk portfolio. And a lot of that comes out of the stock market downturn back in the early 2000s, where people looked to private equity investments as a way to get a little bit higher return without exorbitant risk. And so there's a few parameters in the bill that really drive where these types of investments go and the kind of risk that the insurance companies are taking on. So I guess far be it for us at the state to tell insurance companies how to invest their reserves and what kind of risk profile to have in that overall, but what we are saying is that for these particular investments, we're going to drive that not to the absolute highest risk companies coming out of their garage to try and bring some great idea to the market, but a number of parameters like the total money, total dollars available in the program, the percent of the credit, the time frame within which they have to deploy all of their investment money. All of this is geared towards, let's call it, smaller companies, growth companies that have an opportunity to grow, but not the highest risk, earliest stage companies that might, kind of have the state providing an unintended incentive to insurance companies to get overly exposed on the risk side of their reserves.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Cassidy and Representative Downey, this is a bill that's been around for a long, long time. I've sat through one presentation after another. I won't go into the tax policy because this is going to taxes.
Yeah, that's correct.
I have never supported this CAPCO for a whole set of reasons. One of them being that primarily the financial institutions that drive this are East and West Coast, and almost every state, one of the major complaints is that it's not driven by local companies. It's driven by large companies that bring a presence into the state of half a dozen or a dozen back office people, and it's still driven by people outside the state, whether it's Tennessee. And actually, I kind of like the way Tennessee did it, and I will see if I can forward that from last year, which turned this whole process on its head and said it had to be local, could not be driven by national companies. So my question, what, for Mr. Cassidy or Representative Downey, in this bill, what has changed from 2 years ago and 4 years ago that has taken away the incentive for national companies to come in, take this money, and their profits, which typically get up to the 20 and 30 and 40% off of that $160 million, and take it out to the East and West Coast? What has changed dramatically that will stop that from happening and keep that $40 or $50 million that typically flows out of your state, what will keep that here?
Actually, in every program, even a firm like ours, which has participated in 8 different states, we have to partner locally. So we actually don't bring people in from out of state. And for those who are familiar with small business investing, it's a local game. I happen to be from Minnesota, so I'm born and raised, so I have a little bit of a different vantage point here. But if I wasn't, it would make no sense for me to try to pick up and move to Minnesota to establish an investment fund. It's not the way it works. So the result of that, and by the way, we're a participant in the Tennessee program that you referenced, have terrific local partners there and are really proud of what we're doing there, as we are in our other states. We have local partners in every place where we go. Sometimes the local partners are people that can't raise outside capital because of the capital markets, particularly in today's world, and they'll join my firm. Other times, we'll just engage them. So Alabama is an example where we've engaged them, as we have in Tennessee and elsewhere. So we've always been supportive of requirements that ensure that the local investment community is one of the beneficiaries of this program, and that we can use and leverage the local talent.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Downey.
If I could add, in addition to that, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I don't know all the history, but I do remember even in my first 2 years here, this bill changed quite a bit in that last two-year period, and I know you were instrumental in that, and there were lots of discussions with lots of different people. I would draw folks' attention. I think my page number and line numbers are the same, but on line 2.8, you'll notice that the business investment company needs to have its principal office located or headquartered in Minnesota. And then on line 2.20, the actual businesses being invested in need to be headquartered in Minnesota, principal business operations in the state, and at least 80% of the employees located in Minnesota. And you could perhaps argue that the that some portion of the return on investment could end up going back out of the state to those who are investing in the state from outside the state. But I can also tell you, when you're recruiting capital, bringing outside money into the state of Minnesota to develop businesses here is a good thing. And the replication, the investments that are made in these companies are only partially funded by this chunk of money and sent it through the Minnesota program. It'll bring other collateral investment in as well, as you full well know from some of the other projects and bills you've worked on. So I think, again, I hope, and if people have suggestions for how to maybe tune the parameters better, I think we've got the right mix in terms of the risk profile and the way to actually drive the residual benefits of the tax credits so that they stay and accrue to Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm really not asking for an answer anymore. It's just a rhetorical. There has been no explanation of what changed from 4 years ago or 2 years ago, and I will allow that you're going to have an awful lot of fun when you get to the tax committee and Representative Lincheski, and I'll just leave it at that. But if this is a vote at this particular time, it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, at the Commerce Committee, I had several questions which raised a lot of concern among other members, and you were going to get the answers to me promptly. I still haven't heard. Have Are you going to get those eventually, or?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, could you repeat those questions? My recollection was that there were questions about other states that had challenges with these programs a decade or so ago, much of which we have learned from, and that we were going to try and provide back to you a recap of those prior states' experiences. Is that what you're referring to?
Was that Mulry?
Yes, but they weren't like a decade ago. They were recently.
Was there Downey?
Mr. Chairman, if I could refer to Mr. Cassidy, and he was going to provide that information and may have some of it at least here today.
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, I think you're alluding to some of the job numbers that were produced on the chart that we handed out in committee. And
there was about three different issues.
To tackle that one first, referring to the discrepancies between Wisconsin and New York and the amount of investment between the two states and the job reduction numbers. And we now have a resident expert with us that can actually address that issue. Mr. Cornegal.
Yeah, across all of the different states, there are a couple of variables in terms of cost per job. The biggest driver, actually, is the additional capital that we were just talking about that these programs tend to attract. They've got a great history of doing so, and sometimes it's 2-1, sometimes it's as much as 6-1, and that can be a real driver of the outcome. And then the other driver is just individual successes. The programs tend to perform within certain bands, but you have outliers when there are particular home runs that can generate sort of off the charts job growth in particular circumstances, and that's happened in some of the locations.
Still have a question?
Not completely on that one. And what about, there was two more and I can't remember, they're up in my office someplace.
Representative Mulry, you bring the questions to Representative Downey. He'll get you the answers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, they said they'd have them for this committee.
You'll get them to me, too. Will you please?
Mr. Chairman, there were questions about, I believe it was Florida, who had an early program that actually did not have the time limits on the and the parameters kind of fine-tuned to more stable investments. In fact, it was a little bit capitalizing on what one could pretty easily argue was an overly hot investment strategy, and they did have some problems with the returns there. And again, I know Mr. Cassidy and others are working to pull together that data, and I guess we'll just restate our commitment to get you the answers.
Okay, anybody else have a question? Do you still have a question? I don't want to shortchange it.
I don't have any more questions.
Thank you. Anybody, Representative Clark.
Thank you, and I'm sorry I missed the first part of the presentation, but it is along this line of jobs created. Do you have some figures on the average wages of the jobs that are created with any of these investments? Am I missing something?
Mr. Cassidy.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, so the answer is?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, we do have job figures and salary figures. They tend to be higher average salaries, and we can get you that information. Most of that information is produced on an annual basis in each state by state in terms of the jobs that are produced and what the average salaries are, so we will get that information to you.
And Mr. Chairman, and this is after a period of what time that the jobs are created?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, the hope is that the capital will be deployed immediately and that job growth will also begin to inure immediately as well. This program is meant to invest in growth companies, and that means deploying capital and starting job growth immediately.
Starting what immediately, did you
immediately,
say?
Immediately, job growth.
So, Mr. Chairman, so this $50,000 salary, average annual salary in Alabama, is that's the average of Alabama jobs created with this? How many jobs are we talking about here, do you suppose, in Alabama? $50,000 average. $2,129 jobs that pay an average of $50,000.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, the job creation in Alabama, the number that we have is 2,129 jobs.
And Mr. Chairman, I noticed it says created and retained. Do you know which parts are actually created and which parts are retained of that 2,000?
Both.
Do you have the differential between the creation and the maintenance of the jobs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, we can get you that information as well.
Thank you. I appreciate
provide
that.
Provide that out.
Mr. Chairman, if I
could. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I draw members' attention to page 11 of the bill. And I can't remember who amended this into the Angel Investment Tax Credit bill last year, but we have the same reporting mechanism and a report due from the Department of Employment and Economic Development on the Angel Investment Tax Credit. And this is the exact same reporting requirement for this program as well. So it's a point well taken. I think tracking what actually comes about as a result of these investment programs is a good thing. And you will notice on 11.19, the number of jobs created will be part of that report. So we'll do a nice audit of these programs and the companies that receive the investment and the success.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Oh, I didn't see.
Just a word of advice, because we've had such trouble trying to figure out how to pay for those reports. You might want to figure out somewhere in your bill how you're going to pay for those reports, because otherwise all you can do is ask the companies to contribute to the cost. Otherwise, and I know you don't want to do this, Representative Downey, you're contributing to expanded spending from state government.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, I can confirm with the department and will do that, but my understanding is that the administrative costs in the department are covered by the certification and application fees. If not, we'll want to make sure we get that cleared up.
Very well. Seeing no other questions, Representative Leiniger.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 288, recommend that it be passed and forwarded to the
Tax Committee.
The Tax Committee.
288. Very well. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you
Chairman.
Very much. Close to one. Okay, now we have presentation of labor and industry. Commissioner, welcome to our committee again.
Right?
Well, when you put a state requirement on, here's a bill.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Today I'd like to go through our budget with you. And the way I'd like to proceed is to give you a quick overview of our budget and then in the various divisions, and then go to the change item. And I have them.
You'll get them after this.
You have them before you in two different forms. One is the form that's on, that'll be on the screen, but also you have the budget, the regular budget stuff. And that's, I think, page 7 through 15 or something. I'm not sure what the pages are, but the change items. But we will be going off the PowerPoint. I think that's easier to understand. We are not asked for any major significant, well, there are some, but not real a lot of changes. I'll begin with the revenues of the Department of Labor and Industry, Mr. Chairman, that I think is on page 4 of your of the material we gave you. This is the department gets very few general funds. You can see it's less than 1% of total funding for our department, for the Department of Labor and Industry, is from the general fund. The chief source of funds, 73%, is the workers' comp, fund, which is assessed against the insurers and employers of Minnesota. I think the assessment now is somewhere around 8%. The second largest is the construction code and licensing, the various electrician's board, the plumbing board, those type of boards that basically are fee for service, and that's 17% of our total, or $43 million for the biennium. Then we get 10% of our, or 4% of our budget from the federal government, $10 million. Most of that goes for the OSHA program. Then we get some special revenue and several other smaller ones. But those are our major sources of funds. Our expenditures, which is the next page you have before you, is you can see work comp benefits. This is these are monies that do not really come to the department. They go out in checks and medical costs for recipients of workers' comp. In 1996, the legislature terminated two substantial work comp programs, the supplemental benefits and the second injury fund. However, there are still individuals who were covered by those programs prior to the termination and so are still receiving funds out of there. Those will end somewhere between 2045 or 2050. So no one knew was entering it, but these are just people with old injuries that are still receiving funding. This also includes the uninsured employer fund for uninsured employers when an individual gets hurt and his employer is not insured. The next largest expenditure, 19% of our expenditures, is in the construction codes area. That's $50 million over the biennium. That covers the work of the electrical board, the plumbing board, the high-pressure piping board, et cetera. And those are all fee-for-service, as I said. And 18% of our expenditures goes to administer the workers' comp program and OSHA. These money all come out of the workers' comp assessment, but they do go for administering the program in various ways, some in the department, some outside the department. Then we have, labor standards, which is an apprenticeship is $4 million, less than 2% of our total cost. And our general support, as you can well imagine, is simply human resources, accounting, lawyers, computer people, that sort of thing. So those are just a quick overview of our expenditures. This next table, the next page, is across. This just breaks down how much funds go external to our department, how much is used internal. If you go across the top, you'll see that 27% of all expenditures are in salary for the 431 FTEs. Operations 3%. So the total of our budget that goes into agency operations is 30% external. From our funds are 70%. Then we go right down. If you go down the table, you'll see the various places where those external funds go. The first one is the Vinland Grant, which is a rehabilitation unit in Loretto, Minnesota, for hard to rehabilitate individuals. That's just a grant of $200,000. Benefit claims are much more substantial. That's the one I just talked about, $70 million for 1 year. For supplemental benefits, second injury funds, and uninsured employers. Then we also pay for the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, $1.7 million. Part of the Office of Administrative Hearings, about $7.2 million. $750,000 that goes to the Commerce Department for fraud investigations, and $100,000 for MMB. Under OSHA Workplace Safety Consultation, we do safety grants. This is a very good program. I think we talked about it last time when I was here. That's $998,000. Then we have a loggers rebate program, which was set up about 20 years ago, and it's kept. What had happened was the loggers' work comp rates were very high, among the highest in the state, and this program is our rebates from the loggers go into safety training. It's been a very successful program, and I think some people say it's allowed companies and the whole industry to stay in business. Then we have the contractor recovery fund, which is for if you have a home builder that in one fashion or another does not deliver what she or he promises, you can sue. If you get a judgment, you get paid out of this fund if the contractor is unable to pay it himself. That's $3.3 million. That's paid for out an assessment on contractors. Then that $7.1 million goes to pay our 83 contract electrical inspectors. Most of our electrical inspections, particularly outside the Twin Cities area, are done by contract. They're not done by department employees. So that's when business is good, they can do very well, but when business is bad, when there's not very much construction or demand for their work, they make less money. And so those are just contractors and not employees. but they, we do rely upon them for most of our electrical inspections. The next chart is just to takes a closer look at the workers' compensation fund. Sometimes it's called the special fund, and spending items there, as I said earlier, supplementary benefits cover over the biennium for $100 million, cover about 3,000 claimants. Second injury benefits come to about $21 million. Uninsured employers and bankrupt self-insured employers, that's $19 million. Then the cost of administering the workers' comp program and the portion of occupational safety and health programs is $48 million. And then the other ones, you can see those, the outside agencies that we deal with. The Workers' Compensation Division's operations account for $21 million. Whoops, I went ahead, but I don't know how to go back. Well, anyway, forget it. You play with it. Anyway, that's our operations is $21 million. And then the next area is OSHA compliance, or workers' compensation, I'm sorry. You can see our benefit payments are $140 million and our operations are $21 million. And that covers claim service investigations, benefit management, data management, and bulk rehab. OSHA compliance. OSHA compliance is paid half out of state funds, which comes out of the workers' comp assessment funds, and half out of federal funds. So it's a 50-50 partnership that the state conducts with the federal government. And our total state budget there is for $16 million. We have 85 employees there. OSHA consultation is a little different in that they do not do inspections. Instead, they provide advice to employers as to how to make their workplace safe. And that's paid 90% out of the federal funds and 10% of our funds. And our total budget there is $7 million, but that's not our, I'm not sure.
That includes the
10%. That includes the 10%. So, The next slide I put up just as goes through the expenditures by activity of the Workers' Compensation Division. Mr. Chairman, we're not asking for any change items to the Workers' Compensation Division. It's working fairly well. We think the budget that was used last year works going to work reasonably well for this year. So we're not making any change items at all there, Mr. Chairman. Our next division is in... Here we will see some change items. Construction codes and licensing. We have a number of construction boards in our department, 113 employees, 112.9, and then as I said earlier, 83 contractors. Biennial budget there is $50 million. It's all fee for service. That is, that there are no tax dollars that go into it, no general fund dollars. It's all funds, funds that are generated through fees on licenses, permits, and that sort of thing. And you can see the areas we cover: building codes and standards, residential building contractors, electrical licensing, plumbing and engineering, boilers, high pressure piping, boats for hire, and independent contractor certification. And we license, certify, register, variety of things like that. The budget there is $50 million, and we get $43 million for construction code and $7 million by special revenue, and that's the contractor recovery fund. Labor standards and apprenticeship is also an area which we will have a change item. Labor standards is the only area in the department that's funded through the general fund. Labor standards provides labor and employment, or minimum wage enforcement, overtime enforcement, child labor laws, prevailing wage, parental leave, and employer rights regarding termination, wages due, rest periods, variety of things like that. We have 9 employees there. They receive about 24,000 phone calls a year and thousands of questions via email. Prior to doing investigations, we generally get complaints from employees. We don't go out and investigate places without a complaint from an employee. There's no possible way we could do it otherwise. And then we have the apprenticeship division, which has 6.5 employees, and that's funded. It's a $2.2 million budget. It's funded out of the workforce development funds. So there's no general fund dollars go from that. That's all workforce development. The apprenticeship unit regulates and supervises and promotes apprenticeship programs that have been approved and meet state and federal standards and provide assistance to employers needed. This is pretty, a fairly small program, too, as you can see. The total budget there is $4 million between those two areas. Then our final, the final division is called the General Support Division. And that's computer people, human resources, finance, administrative staff like myself, and others come out of there. We allocate the funding from that based on the amount of work we do, workers' comp and special revenue, the construction code, and federal. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to talk about our change items. Basically, we have three. We did not do a slide of this one, but we're going to have three changes. One is going to be the governor's proposed a 5% cut in the fair labor in the labor standards area. Second will be extension of the surcharge for $4.50 on building permits that was instituted last year. We'd like to see that extended for another 2 years. And our third change item request is a number of small items left over from the overall of the construction codes and licensing area last year. So I'll go through each of those in detail now. The governor is proposing a 5% cut in the labor standards budget. That comes in at $1.7 million for the biennium. And he is proposing a $43,000 cut each year of the biennium, or 5% in that area. And that means would result in a reduction of 0.5% of a labor investigator's his salaries and benefits. And that will inevitably result in some delays. Now, outreach and education, hopefully that would not be very much, but there would be some. We have one less person, you're going to have, they'll do fewer, less work. That stands to reason. Our next change item is, this is the one that you may have heard more about. The legislature in the past, since the first time it did in 2002, then it started doing it again in earnest in 2006, has been taking money from the construction code fund, the construction funds, and giving them to the general fund. For the last biennium, we took $1.5 million each year. The governor is proposing to continue that practice of doing for the next biennium $1.5 million. What we'd like to do is continue a surcharge of $4.50 on each building permit that was instituted last year at the suggestion of the Contractors Association. That raised about $1.2 million per year. So that helps offset the dedication of money to the general fund. And it turns out to be a $5 fee because the municipalities get 50 cents and the state gets $4.50. So it's a $5 surcharge. It'll just go on every building permit. And this was proposed by the contracting community.
Representative Clark, do you have a question?
No, just to explain it. I was going to say the document says 5, so you explained okay. That 50 cents is added.
Yeah. It gets a little tricky there. Yeah. But it's $4.50 and 50.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Then this is just a history. The next slide is just a history of those general fund transfers. For those of you who want to see what happened in the past, the first in 2002, $2 million was taken. 2006, $6 million was taken. 2008, $1.6 million. 2009, $3.5 million. And last biennium, $1.5 million was taken each year. So you can see that out of that fund, $16 million has been taken out. We've discussed this in the past, Mr. Chairman, in this committee, and sort of acknowledgement that there may not have been any place else to go for the money, but it's not the best public policy. I think that's a fair assessment.
I concur with that.
And this we don't need to look at this one. This doesn't tell us too much. This just says what our funds will be.
Hey, you can bring that up now, aren't you?
Of course I am, Mr. Chair, if I might. I think this is the best slide here.
All right.
I'm looking at the construction code and licensing division where it goes through the budgetary year, fiscal years, and 2012, 13, 14, 15. Am I looking at this correct and seeing a deficit of $500,000, $500,000, $1.7 million?
No.
No, I'm not. And why did you print it that way?
It doesn't
just
say
to make me look stupid.
You see, it says a difference, not a deficit. So it's not a deficit, just the difference in if we did not have the surcharge, what would the consequence be?
If we didn't have the surcharge.
Is that your question?
Well, no, that leads to another question, Mr. Chair.
What?
Representative Mahoney.
So if we didn't take that $1.5 million every year, would we not have that deficit there? Or that difference, not a deficit, that difference. Would we not have that difference if we didn't take that $1.5 million?
That is the difference in, I'm sorry, this is the difference between receipts and expenses. So our policy has been to try to keep a fund balance of around 20%. And so that extra money would just be, we're expenses, I'm sorry, I took a look at the wrong way. we would be exceeding expenses by 529, yes. We're hopefully that we'll recover that through increased activity and construction activity.
You'd recover that through what?
Through increased construction activity.
But your intent is not to propose to remove removal of $1.2 million from construction code licensing ever. That's going to go on now forever?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, we have requested, at your request, we talked to the MMB to talk to the governor's office, see what the possibility would be of simply having this last for 2 years and then dropping it. We have not received a response yet. We would certainly prefer that.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might. I just want to be consistent. I've never liked the idea of using permit monies to fund general fund, either at a city, local level, which is done tremendously. I mean, I think there's even a lawsuit that said it was illegal, and I don't know how the cities are able to, particularly in suburbs, use building permit fees for parks and schools and police departments and I don't know how we don't ever prosecute a city, but that's another story. And we managed to keep that out of state government, and I would love to blast my people on the other side of the aisle, but I think I'd get blasted right back, which would be good. But this is really, really bad policy. You know, you're expanding the distance for these, particularly for the electrical division, of how much area they have to cover. And the reports I'm getting back from the electrical inspectors is that their payments, where they used to be a week to 10 days, I won't give dates and times, I mean extensions, but they're getting dramatically delayed. And literally, you're charging a building permit in Minneapolis or a building permit in Mazeppa to cover the cost of child care in Duluth this way. And it's really bad policy. You know, I've got a bill in. I hope we have a hearing on it. Looking for other ways to do this, because this, we've got to stop doing robbing Peter to pay Paul. And it's something that was handed to you. It was handed to the governor. It started in the legislature. But members, we do this all the time, and in building codes, when we don't inspect, when we take money from inspection, we inspect less. When we inspect less, we put the public at risk. And if you're a building contractor, you ought to be really royally teed off. So I've preached today a little bit, so I'll stop.
Commissioner, you got anything to say about that? I don't know if there's a question in there or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, all I can say is that many, I guess, public administration specialists or political scientists would say it's a bad policy to do it. At the same time, we recognize that the legislature and the governor have a difficult time finding sufficient general funds to pay for what you need to do.
Representative Scalzi first, and Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to chime in on this because it is bad public policy, and every time I take out a permit to put in a furnace, Last year it was 50 cents for the state surcharge. This year it's $5. So when you make decisions on the state level to not raise taxes, then you make the homeowner pay this surcharge because it's funding the department. But I don't pay that surcharge. I tack it on to the homeowner. They pay the surcharge. So that homeowner has just had their taxes raised $5 because they had to have something replaced in their home. That's what's wrong with it.
Representative Mulry.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if research remembers there's a statute actually saying we're not supposed to do that either, and plenty of administration ignored it, and I suppose that's just going to continue, but there is a statute, and I didn't want to bring it up. You want to say we're perfect and the local governments are terrible.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you've got 83 contractors here that do electrical inspections for you, and looks like they make about $90,000 a year. How many inspections do they do for that?
Many.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murray. It's going to vary from year to year. They get paid. I don't remember. Do you remember how much it's in? It's a geographically based based number. Some can do very well on it. Some make more than 90. Some make less than 90. I think that's the most honest way I can say it. It is depends on how far you have to travel, what actually is the job, how complicated the job is of inspecting. Now we're not paying. Remember, these are individuals who are they're private contractors, so we're not paying their benefits, or we have no obligations for pensions.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, is that all these guys do then, or do they do their own?
Some do. Some are full time. Some have other jobs.
Okay,
it varies. So it's very likely that the inspector you have at your home is a private contractor.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murray.
And then just as a follow-up, I noticed then you have 112.9 additional employees, and that should leave your budget at about $43 million. If my math is correct, that's like $400,000 per employee. Now, I know a quarter of that's probably for wages and that, but what do these employees all do, and where do all those dollars go?
I'm not sure about your I'll let you look at the math there, but we have a number of other there are inspectors and there are elevator inspectors. There are plumbing inspectors, high pressure piping inspectors, boiler inspectors. So there are a whole number of other inspectors.
So most of them are just in house inspectors.
Yes, most of them are in house. Electrical ones are the only ones that are contracted outside. Then there are office staff. Then we also do a lot of review of building permits and of building plans that come in that engineers and others take a look at. And so there are a variety of functions that are done. That's your question. Most of them are inside.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's an answer that woke me up. The amount that the electrical inspector gets is based on geography. So I would like you to give me those numbers, because I hope that someone that does electrical inspections in Black Duck gets paid at least 25% more than someone that does electrical inspections in Richfield.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative House, I don't have the information. I'll get it to you. I'll get it to the chairman to you as quickly as you can.
I would appreciate that.
The division of how those fees are set.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
I appreciate the question, too. It's a good question.
Anybody else have any questions? Representative Stensrud.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious. It sounds like the electrical inspectors are sort of outsourced. You have a model that works, particularly for outstate. Have you looked at that model for all the other inspectors that you mentioned? And if you can confirm, those are all in-house, state-employed, compared to electrical?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stensrud, there aren't nearly as many of the other ones in terms of different fields. The electrical ones account for like one-third of the total number of inspections that we do. Electrical inspections are needed everywhere. The other ones are... There are fewer of them. There probably would, I think in the plumbing areas, maybe 10 or 12, 15. So they would simply not, would not be as cost effective to contract those people out as the electrical area. At the same time, I think we got to keep looking at it.
Thank you.
Anybody else? I have to, long as the subject's been kind of brought up, I have to confess to something that happened when I was chairman before, is the governor and the commissioner decided that they wanted to cut electrical inspectors' fees because there's a big surplus that was building. They thought they'd never, ever have to access and run out of that money. And I saw the electrical contractors in 500 North South, and I went up to talk to them, and it was with fear and trepidation that I walked into the room, but I did take a lot of the money for electrical inspection, and a perfect storm did hit. We went to a period of time when they weren't inspecting very often, and there wasn't there, and that money was eaten up, and they ran out. I'm glad you're taking care of that, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, hopefully we will be.
Yep.
The next our next area is simply one that we withdrew a fee. We had a fee adjustment proposal into you that the governor had approved, and we withdrew it last week. The it was a $2.2 million. We call it a fee adjustment proposal because some of the areas weren't quite covering their weight, but in other areas it was an actual increase. We looked at the potential. If you can look at this chart we have there, it's the there was a precipitous decline in housing housing construction that went on between 2007 to the present time. We all know about that due to the recession. Construction is now picking up. We have every evidence to see that. We're not quite sure how much, but it is picking up, and so we feel comfortable in not asking to for this other fee increase. So we are going to withdraw it. I think it would be unwise stewardship to ask for more than we actually needed. We think that there will be a satisfactory amount coming in, so we will not ask for that increase. Of course, if you want to give me more money, you can go right ahead. I'm kidding. Seriously, that we do not need the money. I'm not really kidding.
There will be a day.
Then finally, our last change request is simply a leftover from an overall last year of the code licensing statutes, and that they're in total amount to $68,000 of fee increases next year and $31,000 the following year. These are mostly due to just simple oversights. One was due to a law that was passed after the overall was done. I'll quickly go through those. The first one's medical gas vacuum certification fee adjustment. The fee was $35 per year. We want to change that to $40 for 2 years. So actually, they're saving. You can do the math. They're saving $30 over the. That time period, so it's consistent with our fee schedule. So that is actually a cost, so loss there. Then extending the continuing education course approval fee. All these various trades or licensed occupations require continuing education. What we do like to do is all the people in that business would like to make sure they're on the up and up, and so we do ask them to be licensed. And so we are asking for a fee to cover the cost of those licenses for 99 continuing education providers. It'll be $11,000 first year and $7,000 the second year. So it won't be, it's not a great deal. Just basically making sure those people have some backing, that they know what they're doing, so we can check into their work. The signed contractor bond registration fee is for $6 million and $6 million each year, or $6,000 each year. Signed contractors is referring to the people who put up billboards. Now you can get a bond, there are two ways you can bond for that. One, you can get a bond within a city, a municipality. The other is you get a statewide bond that covers all municipalities. The signed contractors came to us and they said we want to do a statewide one. And so they requested that we put this in so they can get a statewide bond that will cover all their work. So they don't have to get a bond each time, each municipality, they put in a new sign. The pipeline bond filing fee is another situation where these are the people that lay the pipe that goes from the main line into your home or to your commercial building. And this was an omission in the bill. I'm just trying to correct that for $7,000. It was just an oversight last year. The backflow prevention tester registration program is backflow prevention devices are used in a variety of places, but Sorry, backing up. These do two things. This would do two things. One is to require a registration, and you have to re-register every few years. I'm not sure what it, 2 years. The present situation, you don't have to renew it, and so we've got a number of people registered to these things who are dead, so they're no longer involved in the activities. We want it to be done every 2 years, and so. And then, as you did when you did a backflow prevention device, when you looked at it, you'd put a tag onto it. It'd say what your number is, and then if I did one, put a tag on. Someone could see my number's 123. They could call the department, find out who actually did it, and they'd find out it was Ken Peterson. They'd go out and ask me what the situation was when I did it. Also, all we're doing is simply requiring these people to register and to keep up the registration, and put a tag on the device when they're done with a number on the registration number. It's a fairly simple thing, but it has caused problems once we found out that we had some dead people being registered. It doesn't work.
Representative Clark.
So, Mr. Chairman, this last thing is dealing with plumbing, basically? Plumbers?
There are people, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, there are individuals, some of these people are plumbers, some are actually just testers. Their full-time occupation is testing.
I guess I'm just interested to know that if someone does do some work in this, they're supposed to put a tag on it. Right now, the existing law says they're supposed to tag it?
Existing law says they are supposed to tag it, but it doesn't have a number on it. Find out who actually did it.
What do you suggest be done if you are aware of a situation where there's no tag ever been put there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I'm really not an expert. I would think they would call the department, try to run down who was doing it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, she probably has to get a permit with a $5 charge and have the inspector come out.
It could certainly be worth it to prevent a backflow if that's going to be a problem.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, we'll get back to what happens on that. I just don't know.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Commissioner, I'm a little confused about backflow preventers. Could you explain what they do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, absolutely not.
Representative Paymar.
If he's done, because I wanted to go back to something. I didn't know if he was done with it.
I'm done.
Can we go back to I don't remember, Mr. Chair, when you were chairing this committee before that we did this. Before, but this, I am a little confused about this construction codes and licensing division. So that's, just so I understand correctly, so that, is there a surplus in this account? That's the first question. And secondly, if the money is being transferred to the general fund, are there aspects of what this division does that you're not doing?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar. There's a surplus to the extent that we have a fund balance that allows us to get from high points of the funding to low points. You have certain times in the year when you have lots of money coming in. Like right now, a lot of money is coming in because people are getting permits for the construction season. In October, that money will go down. So you need a fund to, a surplus to sort of go through the ebbs and tides or the ups and downs of the year. So we do have we try to keep a 20% fund balance. And that's also necessary in case we have another drop off in construction work so we can cover that period until we get a chance to figure out what's going down and maybe and then do layoffs after that. But you need a fund balance. Now your next question though is about the $1.5 million, and yes, there are things we have not been able to do or do as quickly. I think that's a better way of putting it. That we've always been able to do the work, but it's not done as quickly. And that's been a source of great frustration to contractors and other people who are covered by the division because the work simply can't be done as quickly as they'd like. That's why the surcharge, which Representative Scalzi mentioned, I talked about, the $4.50 surcharge, was instituted simply to give us enough funds to go out and do the work that needed to be done.
Mr. I'm not sure I totally understand all of this because when I chaired the Public Safety Finance Division, we did something similar with the fire safety account with the Governor Pawlenty's blessings. But there was actually a surcharge, and there wasn't a lack of training for firefighters. But I'm hearing from you, Commissioner, that we're actually not able to provide, unless I didn't hear that right, provide services at the same level that should be if the money was actually in the account.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymer, that is correct. Your last statement is we're not able to provide it as quickly as we'd like to, or as some contractors and other building owners or customers would like it to be provided. It gets provided, but it's not as quickly as we'd like.
I think Mr. Soderberg might be able to enlighten us of the past.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is an interesting subject. I think what people, the best way to visualize what happened in this area is that if you think of a bank, and as long as money is coming in, and when you have a very good construction, there's a lot of permits being taken, there's a lot of activity happening, and a lot of money is coming in the front door of the bank. And eventually they're buying for a service, but the service may be delayed a 6 months or a year after, let's say, they're doing a major remodel in a home. Eventually they're going to get done with the remodel and somebody's going to come in and inspect the electrical work or the plumbing work or whatever was done. And so what's happened is when the economy downturn came, is there wasn't as much money coming in the front door of the bank as needed to come out the back door, because now there's a bunch of people on the back end saying, hey, I paid you 6 months ago, I need the money. And what happened is that you had this time when there was a lot of money sitting in the bank waiting for this transaction to flow through. But I think there's quite a misunderstanding about the 1.5. And I've heard this story, you know, many, many times, and I'll tell you what the real story is. What happened is in 2005-07, a lot of these funds were paid for out of the general fund. The money went to the general fund and was reappropriated out of the general fund. Some were special revenue funds, some were statutory funds, others were direct appropriations. And so they said in 2007, let's bring, plus there was an effort to bring all the construction code things together, rather than having some over in administration and some in Dolly and some in commerce. They decided they're going to bring it all into Dolly so that it could be a little more efficient. But to do that, it left the general fund $1.5 million short, because all the money was now going to go into the construction code fund, and it used to go into all these other funds, including the general fund, but what we appropriated out of the general fund was $1.5 million less than what we were bringing in from these activities. So the deal was made at the department's request, I might add. This idea the legislature stole this money at the department's request, to the administration's sign off, that we will do to make the general fund whole, we will transfer every year $1.5 million from this fund to the general fund. Everybody was happy. And I don't know where this idea that this money was stolen or anything else ever came up, but that's the history of what happened. And I've heard this a million times, it's been stolen. And it is, I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong, but that is the history and the facts on how this came to be. And I'm not saying if anybody could recreate the world, you wouldn't do it this way, but this is the world as it exists.
Got a history lesson.
Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymer, prior, just a couple, three years ago, I think it was, the electrical inspectors in the state were, there was over 104. Some were part of less than 12 of them were part-time. And what's happened is with the, you know, and I might dispute Mr. Soderberg, but I'll leave it at, you know, leave it alone. With the shrinking of that particular fund, they are now at 83 or 85 inspectors, and the areas that they have gone into, the geographic areas they cover, have gotten much larger. So what's happening in construction, and I'm sure other people on this committee can tell you, is that what used to take 24 or 36 hours to get an inspector out there is now taking 36 and 72 hours, sometimes even a week,
And what happens is you get backed up on your construction sites. I would never think a good licensed contractor would, but sometimes something gets covered up and it doesn't get as inspected to the level that it probably should at this particular time. I wouldn't have any hard data on that, but it's just a sense or a feeling that it might be happening out there. And that's the problem that comes in.
Seeing no questions, you got anything you want to contribute more, Commissioner?
No, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the time the committee, the time the questions in the committee. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you being here. Thank you. You enlightened us greatly.
Thank you.
And with that, which one has read the minutes thoroughly and already?
Here, I've read the third. I'll move the minutes.
Representative Mahoney moves the minutes of March 3rd. All in favor of that motion? First, is there any additions or corrections? Hearing none. Representative Mahoney, move the minutes of March 3rd. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Are we still underneath the business of the committee? If I might ask. I know that we've been, the deadline is quickly coming up on the budget proposals. Do you have any sense or timeline for the budget for this particular division to come out or to be presented to the committee? And
After next week?
Mm-hmm. So sometime around the 20th or thereabouts?
Right in that area.
And we're going to review it? Are we going to hear the bills on an individual basis?
You're going to be able to review the bill. You'll be able to make amendments to change the bill. And we will be very willing to hear those amendments and consider them.
So, Mr. Chair, in other years, what has happened is that each individual entity has brought forth a bill, whether it's BioBusiness Alliance or Women Ventures or Department of Labor and Industry. Have they brought bills forth, and we've heard them. Are we going to
hear those bills on Thursday?
On Thursday?
Starting here. Might be a little overtime considered, depending how things go.
They write my excuse for the tax meeting.
I will give you an excuse. Any other business be brought before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.